Welcome to Humboldt County Grown, the podcast where we dig into the dirt, the dreams, and the daily lives of farmers here in Humboldt County, California. Today, we're speaking with Molly Travis.
Hey.
And Jared Zystro.
Hello.
From Organic Seed Alliance, about the amazing research they've been doing here in Humboldt County. Today, we're going to be exploring organic seed production, as well as current trends in organic seed research, and the role dry farming plays in Organic Seed Alliance's research here in Humboldt. So to start off, Molly and Jared, thanks for joining us. I'm really excited for this episode because I'm a big fan of your work. I've been following it for a few years. I used to work at a farm that had one of your research plots, the College of the Redwoods Farm. And let's just jump right into it. Can you explain Organic Seed Alliance to us and our listeners?
Yeah, good question, Quillam, and thanks again for having us on your podcast. Organic Seed Alliance, we're a national organization that works to put the power of seed into the hands of growers. What we mean by that is that we really recognize that the seeds that we plant have a huge impact on the success in growing crops. They have a huge influence on the quality and kinds of foods that we all eat. And at Organic Seed Alliance, we really recognize the importance of both the seeds that we have access to and also the seed keepers who have and continue to steward and improve the varieties that we all rely on. So Organic Seed Alliance, we support growers all over the country who work with seed through our research, through our education, through our advocacy. We, Molly and I, are here in Humboldt and have our boots on the ground with our research and our education programs here in Humboldt County. But we have also staff in Washington State, in other parts of California, in Michigan, Wisconsin. So really do a lot all around the country, and a lot of that work ties all together. So hopefully, you know, the research we're doing in other places will be helpful to growers here in Humboldt County, and the research we're doing here in this county we hope will be useful to growers all over the rest of the country.
That is exciting for me, because so often Humboldt County is framed as being kind of cut off from either the rest of the state or the rest of the country, and so it's exciting to have an organization that's got so many different locations around the country, and we've got one right here in Humboldt doing all this great national research. I want to know what is the importance of organic seed compared to conventional? Why do we need an organic seed alliance versus just getting conventional seed? Because I'll admit it, I like using conventional seed. It's cheaper. It seems to grow the same to me. I don't like treated conventional seed, but what's the importance of organic seed?
Yeah, another really, really good question. And I think that something to keep in mind is that if you're growing organic crops, not everyone knows this, but if you're growing organic crops, certified organic crops, you are not necessarily required to use organic seed. There was an expectation when the kind of organic certification, when the more formal organic rules got put into place, that there just wasn't enough organic seed around for organic farmers, regular, you know, fruit and vegetable field crop producers. There just wasn't enough organic seed for them, and so there was an exception where they weren't required, you weren't required to use organic seed if it's not available in the variety or the kind or the quantity you use. But regardless, I think it's really kind of a question to ask, like, why would you want to use organic seed? Certainly that kind of question, if you're a certified organic farmer, that there's this certification requirement around it or encouragement around it, but there's some deeper principles, I think, at work there and things to kind of keep in mind. The first is thinking about what you're supporting, the systems that you're supporting with your seed purchases. So when you're buying organic seed, you're doing a few things. One, you're supporting organic seed producers. So you are continuing to support organic agriculture through your own purchases, and you are supporting organic seed breeding and development. So there's a lot of research out there that shows that organic agriculture and organic agricultural systems, they're of course very diverse and lots of different ways that you can be organic, but they also differ from conventional agricultural systems in the sense that you're using organic inputs. So instead of using inorganic, rapidly available nutrients, you're using, you know, more organically bound, slower release nutrients. You are using, you're more reliant often on your varieties to have natural resistance to pests and diseases because you're not spraying with some of the conventional pesticides. And so seed keepers, organic seed growers, organic seed companies and breeders are all working to develop varieties that thrive in those conditions with organic inputs. And so with your seed purchases, you can choose to sort of support that work. And even if you're maybe not seeing the immediate benefit of a new variety being released that's organically adapted, 5 years down the road, the money that you're spending towards that organic seed could be helping support those varieties. So that's one reason. Without belaboring the point too long, the other thing I think, the other two kind of points of why to consider organic seed. One is, again, kind of thinking about the systems that you want to support as an organic producer. Seed production they're really long season crops. They're also not considered food crops. And so for conventional seed production, actually tends to be one of the kind of dirtier crops out there in terms of pesticide, you know, insecticide, herbicide use, because the really long season crops where controlling pests and diseases is important, and the restrictions around food products don't apply to them. Right. And so conventional seed production can be really a pretty, you know, a lot of times it's happening internationally, but even domestically can be pretty, can result in a lot of issues that ultimately farm workers and the environment bear. And so you can make a choice with your seed purchases to support an alternative system, one that's maybe more in line with your own farming practices. And the final piece, I think something that food companies are thinking about more maybe is a consumer expectation that when you do ask, and there have been surveys for eaters, for buyers of food around, do you think that this organic food was grown with organic seed? If the question is asked, the vast majority of responses are, of course it must be. All the inputs have to be organic because it's organic. And there's a risk point there that food companies are seeing that if consumers learn that the food that they're buying that says organic is being produced with conventional seed, it may potentially create some risk to the integrity of the organic label. There's a lot of other labels out there, right? There's like certified, naturally grown, and regenerative, and a lot of things. Organic, the organic standard is a really strong standard in a lot of ways, and the integrity of that standard is pretty important to a lot of growers and food buyers. So those are some reasons.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the USDA organic label because of that reason, because it's so widely trusted and it's very effective at communicating a higher quality product, a higher premium product to customers, distributors, wholesalers you've never even talked to before, don't know anything about you. And so I think, yeah, it's really important to keep that integrity of the label and identify any gaps where the public might not agree or where it might not match up with public expectations of what organic is. And I think, yeah, it's the label's been out since like the 1980s, I believe, or the program, the USDA.
I'm not an expert in the whole history of the organic movement, but the organic movement started, of course, as a grassroots movement. And some of the early certification agencies were either grassroots led or were became at a state level. And then I believe it was actually all the way not until somewhere like 2002, 2003. This is where my lack of memory is showing. But somewhere around there is when the actual federal national organic program finally got codified and finalized.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so not that long ago in terms of when you think about the USDA label. Yeah, it's only been, you know, a little over 20 years.
Wow. Well, I feel like it's just due now that we are having a better supply of organic seeds so that we can have seeds that are more adapted to organic systems. And I had never thought of that. Like, there's a good amount of, I would guess, like artificial and natural selection happening there that over time makes your seeds just more adapted for a conventional system that's being sprayed with synthetic pesticides, given synthetic nutrients, versus an organic system. I had never thought about that before. That's really interesting to me.
Yeah, it's important for the greater organic seed movement from start to finish to think about organic seed production as a big part of this. So as Jared mentioned, organic farmers can infuse their cultivation practices by trying to source organic seed when possible instead of conventional seed. And in beyond just sourcing, organic farmers can also grow organic seed crops for income. That could include things like cover crop seed, vegetable and flower seeds, and even organic culinary seed, which could be grown for both seed and food sales. So, you know, organic agriculture goes beyond just the usual end product of organic produce.
I've met a few farmers in Humboldt County that do organic seed production, and I'm curious, do you know, are most of these farmers doing organic seed production for research, or are they selling to, are they contracting with seed companies?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different ways people get into growing their own seed, and I think there's a lot of opportunities here, honestly. At the basic level, saving your own seed for your own on-farm use can be really helpful. I think that it's something that can give you, kind of referring back to this idea of like organically varieties that have been selected and seed that has been saved in organic conditions is more adapted to those organic conditions. More specifically, if you're saving seed on your own farm for your own kind of microclimate, for your own production practices, for your own markets, you can really tailor those varieties. And I think there's some really good examples of some local farmers who are not necessarily engaged in commercial sale of their seeds. They're not necessarily growing those seeds to sell to seed companies or to other farmers. They're growing those for their own use, but the varieties that they've developed and preserved through years, decades of on-farm seed saving have been given them a real leg up in terms of resiliency in the face of different climatic conditions, in terms of like having things that really pop at the farmer's market or for restaurant sales that are unique and delicious. So that you definitely see some really good examples of local farmers who are saving seed for their own on-farm use. But then in addition to that, we do see growers who see seed production as an enterprise within their farm. So the routes to that include either retail sales, so taking the seeds that you're growing and putting them in packets and selling them at the farmer's market, or setting up like a seed rack with one of the local grocery stores, or on having, you know, seed packets or seed sales online that you're selling directly from your farm. Or you can, and many growers will do this, you can contract seed with a seed company. So seed companies, organic seed companies, are always looking for new seed growers. And the climate here in Humboldt County is really a good one. Once you get a few miles off the coast, there are a multitude of microclimates in terms of finding the right temperatures. We live in, of course, this Mediterranean climate where we have these generally dry summers, which is perfect for seed production. California is the number one vegetable seed producing state because of those conditions. And Humboldt County really has captures a lot of kind of some of those California climates that allow us to produce, you know, if you get a little closer to the coast, you can do things that are more like the, you know, broccoli seed or beet seed that wanted a little cooler. You go more inland and now you can be looking at, you know, pepper seed, tomato seed, things that like things a bit hotter, but all with this nice, pretty dry, low humidity summers that reduce disease. So it really, there's some really great opportunities there, and we see some local farmers taking advantage of that.
I definitely hear about that with farmers talking about the microclimates, especially our coastal climate, which is a lot more cloud cover. It's a lot rainier. Temperatures go not much below 40 in the winter and not much above 70 in the summer. So very stable, good for cool crops. But then there's the challenge of like, well, I still want to grow tomatoes in my garden out here. What varieties are good for that? And I could see how you can do that on your garden scale too. Like, I've been living in Arcata 2 years now, and I'm on year two of saving all my seeds, but I'm hoping when I'm still in this area 10, 20 years from now, I'll have like really well regionally, coastal, regional, adapted everything. And so I think with all our different microclimates and all our expert farmers and gardeners around here, it's a really exciting thing to get into, especially to the culture of farming and gardening around here. It's easy to find people who understand what you're talking about and have that shared interest. And so I think the idea of turning that into an enterprise is even more exciting for farmers. The idea that we can expand our farms out here and expand our ways that we can be helpful to the greater organic agriculture movement. And I know you've got some test plots out here. One of them is in one of my favorite places in the world, Shively, California. Some of the best soil in the world. That is because you can dry farm there. So I want to ask you, if you could give us an explanation, what is dry farming? What makes it possible out there? And what different kinds of dry farming are there? Because I understand it's not just one, there's not just one way to do it, which is pretty typical in agriculture.
Yeah, so, and I know Molly, you have some things to say for this too, but I'll just share. For those of you who are listening who haven't heard of dry farming before, dry farming is essentially growing crops without supplemental irrigation. So without, you know, there's no overhead watering or there's no drip irrigation, things like that. Typically, what you're looking at is in our Mediterranean climate, this climate where we have wet, rainy winters and dry summers, there are two ways that the crops are going to be getting water. And those are from the stored winter rain. So basically sort of water banking in the soil where you have, where you're typically planting those seeds in the spring. You're using lots of practices that retain as much of that winter water in the soil as possible. So some examples might be you're cutting your cover crop a bit early so that it doesn't evapotranspirate a lot of water, you know, in the dry spring. You're trying to get in early. You're minimizing tillage, especially during, you know, hot, windy, you know, days, to minimize the amount of water that you're sending out of the soil into the atmosphere. You're creating a dust mulch, which means you're just creating a really shallow tillage just on the surface layer that kind of breaks the sort of natural capillary action that water takes to travel through from lower parts of the soil up and out and evaporate into the air. All of those strategies for dry farming to take advantage of that stored winter rain can be used in a lot of different areas in this county and kind of across the West Coast. You do need to be aware of the suitability of your soil for this. And this is where I would point to Oregon State University has their Dry Farming Institute, and they have some really great tools and resources for you to be able to get a sense of, you know, how much water can my soil hold and how easily mm-hmm. can I get a hold of that water come spring. So a lot of it is kind of like the depth of your soil, the water holding capacity of your soil, the amount of winter rain you're getting. So it's kind of like, how much rain are you getting? How much of that are you keeping in the soil until you're ready to use it? For some places, like Shively, like some other areas in river valleys or close to some of our rivers, there's sort of a second source of water there, which is just the groundwater itself. So for, you know, Shively, Pepperwood, that whole area, the Eel River, probably most of the Eel River actually exists below ground, mm-hmm. Traveling through, you know, the gravel bar, traveling through the silt soil there. And so that means that for growers in Shively, that you can have even what above and beyond the winter rainwater that you're storing in that soil, the groundwater table can be, you know, within, you know, 8 inches, 12 inches of the surface, even, you know, deep into summertime. Mm-hmm. And so for growers there, it's really a matter of like, okay, how do you get those crops to germinate, grow through that early season, get their roots down into that groundwater table, and then they're in really, really good place. Whereas for growers, you know, there are growers who are dry farming just, you know, here, like in the Arcata Bottoms, growers that are growing dry farming more inland, and for them, they really are just working with the water that's available in the soil from the wintertime. So they have, wow. You have to use some different strategies for that.
I think of it a little bit like a battery, like for those people who are just don't have that river water access. It's kind of like the winter's like charging mm-hmm. up your big yeah. water battery in your soil and then having to be super efficient about it throughout the year. And then if you're blessed with that groundwater, you're almost plugged in at that point. Out in Shively, it's incredible the way people can just plant tomatoes and they'll look dead for a week while the roots are getting established. But after that, never water them. You weed them maybe 2 or 3 times in the season because you're not irrigating. You're not getting as many weeds. If you're dust mulching, you're definitely, I mean, that's doing your cultivation there. But even where I was at, we didn't necessarily dust mulch. It was pretty, it kind of felt like lazy, neglectful farming, but it worked. We got good yields. And with the amount of labor you didn't have to put into it, taking out irrigation as a factor, it was very much worth it.
And you often can get more concentrated flavors with dry farming, right? There's a lot of kind of branding around it because it can be, especially as kind of the fruit with fruiting crops, tomatoes, melons, things like that, the sugars can kind of get concentrated with that limited water. So now you have kind of this higher value crop that, like you're saying, you're not necessarily having to put as much work into cultivating or running irrigation or things like that. So
I have, a similar theory with that's why the Shively tomatoes, people say they're exceptional. I think it's like, and this is just anecdotal, but something about the plant taking water as it needs it and not going through periods where it has high amount of water and then low amount of water, just a consistent feed. Something about that, at least from what I observed, seems to make good quality flavor in a product.
Dry farming techniques are very location dependent, especially in Humboldt County, just due to the differences between, you know, the coastal versus inland climates mm-hmm. and as well as the microclimates within the individual growing areas. For example, with Amy and Jacques Newcomb out in Willow Creek, they don't have that high of a water table, and it's going to be a lot different from the dry farming that's being done out in Shively or other river bottoms, basically. Mm-hmm. I really like using the UC A&R or the UC Agriculture and Natural Resources planting calendars for Humboldt and Del Norte counties, which you can find on their website. And what's nice about them is they break them down into the sunset climate zones, which is beyond just general plant hardiness. It also counts in or factors in drought conditions as well for your growing region.
That's cool. I will definitely include that in the description. And yeah, I know about the Newcombs and their process for dry farming. And I remember learning about that when Jacques once came to an event you hosted and explained his method for it, and it was interesting to learn that, like we were talking about earlier, some farmers are kind of charging up their water battery, so to speak, in the winter, and managing it very efficiently throughout the year. I think it's also worth noting some farmers dry farm up to a certain point, you know, and then it's dry, and then they have to start using irrigation, and that's not for a complete loss at all. I think it's still very worth to dry farm as much as you can, if you can. I know even in Shively this time of year, or maybe a month or two ago, if you're planting brassicas, the water table's gone down a little bit since the spring. The moisture is maybe, 4 or 5 feet down below where the roots are going to get. So I know there's still reasons maybe to irrigate in an area that's quite prime for dry farming.
Yeah, that you made me think of when you said that is, yeah, dry farming is definitely not a monolith. Mm-hmm. I know there was some research down at UC Santa Cruz where there was a lot of kind of a long tradition of dry farm tomato production in that region. And talking to a lot of different growers that grew what they called dry farm tomatoes, some had kind of considered it to be a little more of what we're talking about, which is like there was no water added. Like the plants were transplanted dry, and like that was it. To other growers that were like, well, no, we always water everything in, but that's the last water we get. To, we actually water all the way until first flowering because we feel like we can get that dry farm flavor, but give all the plants like this early boost to get their roots established and everything. And so there's definitely a range of what people describe of when they say dry farming. It doesn't always mean the same thing.
Right.
And also, I think maybe one other thing, when you're talking about growing the broccoli, it really does. It depends on the crop you're growing. It depends on the time of year you're growing it. And it really depends on the variety. So some times of year, as you said, in summer, late summer establishing crops is really hard to do dry farm. Some crops, again, are not as amenable to that, things that are really shallow rooted and, finicky transplants, but also varieties. One of the things that Organic Seed Alliance has done in the past is done, specific trials to compare, and this is something that the Oregon State University's Dry Farming Institute has done a lot of work too, which is not, even within something like tomatoes or summer squash or melons, there are really, can be really big differences in terms of how different varieties produce, the kind of whether or not they're they really thrive and do well under the dry farming conditions, or their yields suffer, or the plants are really stressed out and are showing kind of like a classic example of tomatoes is blossom end rot, is something that some tomato varieties are very susceptible to when they're under water stress. And all of a sudden you end up with no or close to no marketable tomatoes because they've all got rot on their blossom end versus other tomatoes. Same condition, same water, and all the fruits look nice. Mm. So doing trials and finding the varieties becomes even more important when you're growing in conditions like dry farming.
I know, yeah, tomatoes are so sensitive to water. And it comes down to the variety where you can think you've got it figured out in terms of knowing this is how much water this variety tomato I'm growing is, and then you switch to a different variety and you can get all sorts of problems. And so it makes me wonder, are there traits that you're searching for in dry farming that could be beneficial to someone who's not dry farming, who's just farming in a more conventional irrigation way?
That's a really, really good question, Gwillem. What I would say is that something that So my background, for everyone who doesn't know, is I've done a lot of seed growing in my life, and I've worked at Organic Seed Alliance for a long time, but also have a background in plant breeding. So I've done a lot of research into how do you do selection? How do you find varieties? What traits are you looking at? All those questions. And a kind of a common plant breeding approach is very practical, which is kind of like select and look for what you want. So rather than like spending a whole bunch of time being like, oh, we need to measure whether the pore size of, you know, this plant is, you know, smaller or larger because it might affect its evaporation. Instead, we're just like, okay, if we care about how many marketable tomatoes we can get off these plants, count that and kind of let the plants figure out, like, we don't know. Mm. Maybe that's because it's growing a better root system. Maybe it's because its leaf structure is such that it's not evaporating as much. Maybe because it has some enzymes that can still operate with, you know, lower amounts of water. Like, we don't necessarily know all of the nitty-gritty mechanisms, and usually the focus is on the results. So, but something that we've seen in a lot of research across the board, of this is a kind of a long and old thing that's popped up again and again in plant breeding, which is that stress resistance can be a trait or an attribute that you can see affect multiple things, and the same plant will have stress resistance. If it has stress resistance to drought, it often will also have stress resistance to cold, or to disease. And there are different possible reasons for this, but I think a really good example is with the dark star zucchini. So this dark star zucchini is a Humboldt original. This is Bill Reynolds, a longtime farmer, seed grower, plant breeder down in Shively, had bred this zucchini, this dark green classic zucchini, to thrive in his dry farm conditions. And he was a very good at his plant breeding because, as a seed grower, one of the key things in plant breeding is like having an opportunity to select a lot of plants. So like you want to look at a heck of a lot of plants and find the few that really are the special ones. Mm. And so as a seed grower, Bill, you know, instead of transplanting his zucchini, he would direct seed his zucchini at like one every inch or two. It would just be a thick carpet of zucchini, and he would go through several rounds of thinning to see which of these seedlings is thriving in this stressful dry farm climate. And through that process of selecting for, you know, plants that did well in dry farming, never receiving water, all the way from direct seeding all the way through the end, it turned out that he had these very stress tolerant plants that there was a large zucchini summer squash grower down in organic grower down in Baja. Mm-hmm. Who started buying a lot of Bill Reynolds' Dark Star zucchini seed, because it turns out some of that same stress resistance, which we believe was probably related to the massive roots that it had put on, though Bill never, it's nearly impossible to like take the time to like fork out and lift up every single plant and like look at it and decide this one's got big roots, I'll save the seed from it. Instead, you could just look and say, okay, where did these plants do well in these dry farm conditions? But what happened was some of that same stress resistance, maybe from the roots, maybe from something else, turned out also allowed those plants to survive frosts that wiped out all of these like super fancy, expensive hybrid zucchini seeds. Same thing when like the seeds were, some of the plants were starting to get hit by powdery mildew. Bill's Dark Star got powdery mildew as well. It wasn't genetically necessarily resistant to it, but it tolerated it, and it still would yield. Whereas, again, the hybrids were like these racehorses that if you gave them all the inputs, they could produce. But as soon as they started facing these stresses, they just fell flat. Whereas some of that same breeding and selection in the dry farming carried over to all these other things, even for, you know, non-dry farm growers, potentially even for conventional growers.
I feel like I hear a common theme or strategy going on with plant breeding or seed saving at this level, where it's a mixture of artificial and natural selection, like you were talking about. We're not measuring the pore size of different things to see their like water stress tolerance, because you don't necessarily have capacity to do that much research and make your selection that artificial. So you're kind of letting survival of the fittest take over a bit, and seeing what comes out of that, and trying to notice what is the fittest in this type of cultivation system that we're growing for, which in this case would be organic or for dry farming. And obviously other types of farmers are coming across the same stressors too, whether they're conventional or not dry farming. I also wanted to mention the dry farming. It sounds a bit like the kind of no-till debate, where it's like, well, we're no-till, but we till a little bit. Where dry farming's like that too. So to all our no-till and dry farmers out there, it's not a all or nothing. I think any effort you're doing to reduce your tillage or your water consumption or save resources and build soil, I think it's all worth it.
Yeah, dry farming is extremely diverse, so water is not the enemy per se with dry farming. You know, even here locally in Humboldt, as well across the Southwest with farmers, another tip that I've heard is basically growing for strong roots. I've heard that from some Shively farmers where it's not too hard for them with that high water table, but in the Southwest when it's dry and arid year round, dry farming is kind of just the way that things happen. So some of this can be done through propagation techniques, like how you start the seed and how you plant the small plant, but a lot of it comes down to different techniques as well. So you can use longer and slower irrigation rates to allow the water to sink more deeply down beneath the ground, which can also reduce soil moisture evaporation. What's important about this is you have to remember that generally whatever is happening below the soil is going to get mirrored above the ground in the foliage and fruit. So having strong roots is going to lead to a stronger plant growth, whether it's its foliage or its production. Deeper tap roots can also access more water stored deeply in the ground. Again, not every place has a high water table. Another cool thing about using lower, slower, longer, and broader irrigation is, especially when working with dry farming perennials, like dry farming isn't just going to be your vegetable crops, it's also fruit trees, it's vines, it's flowers, so it's not just annual crops. Having that water extend beyond the tree canopy or the vegetation area doesn't just keep roots close to the base of the plant. So when you have things like high winds or storm damage, having a broader but more stable set of roots can also help with your plant success and not have it die during severe weather events.
It's almost like redefining efficiency in crops, like what you were talking about with hybrids that get all of the resources they could want to produce tons. You could think of that as being a really efficient crop because it can yield a ton if you give it all the right inputs. But I think with what you're talking about, it's like the other way to look at efficiency is having a very resilient crop that can still yield comparably better with less resources and like less relying on perfect conditions. And so I see this is, you know, and that goes hand in hand with organic agriculture because you don't necessarily have those as much of that like controlled environment to make the conditions like quote unquote perfect for your hybrid or supply just the right amount of nitrogen or water or something like this. So I feel like this is really useful for organic farmers, but also just for gardeners, especially with changing climates and less predictable weather patterns. So how can a local farmer get involved either in dry farming or doing seed saving? Like, could a farmer do a research plot with OSA in Humboldt if they wanted to?
This is a really good question, Squillum.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think to the first question of how to get involved in dry farming, I would definitely say if you're interested in dry farming, I mean, this kind of applies to like just about any farming practice, right? My first bit of advice would be to talk to local farmers who are doing it. There's a lot that, you know, has to be very granular, specific to your site, but just a lot of techniques and questions. And so finding the mentors, finding those resources, I would guess that NCGA could be a great spot to kind of come to potentially look, you know, participate in future farmer meetups or ways to connect to other local growers and find folks who are in your area doing dry farming. Like we said before, there's different ways that people are doing it depending on their location and their microclimate. So finding someone who's close to you, who's got some experience, makes all the difference. There's so beyond that, I guess what I would say is I've turned to and found a lot of value in the work that the Oregon State University Dry Farming Institute has been doing. So take a look at theirs, both in terms of a lot of those tools for judging your own site's suitability, in terms of their lists of like varieties that they recommend that have been tested and shown to thrive in dry farming conditions, and in terms of just meetups and events and opportunities to connect with others in kind of throughout really the West Coast doing dry farming, I would point to them. So for your other question, I think about getting involved with OSA's research, we, as I said before, our role really is in working with growers who work with seed, and that covers a really, that's a really big umbrella, because most every grower, unless you are strictly working with like clonally propagated crops, is working with seed in some way or another. I will say that oftentimes our research needs to be conducted on certified organic ground. And so if you do, we have some projects that are coming up here for 2026. If you are certified organic, there could be some specific opportunities for you to join on some of those projects to trial some new organically bred varieties or conduct some seed production trials. But you know, even if you're not certified organic, I'd really encourage you to, you know, reach out to Molly or myself, because we want to support you in your farming research interests, in conducting on-farm trials, doing plant breeding, things like that.
And I would say if you're not certified organic, but you're thinking about it, you should contact me, because right now there is a grant that's open for another month that is helping to pay for farmers' organic certification. So it will cover your fees, your inspection, it'll cover materials you need to transition to organic, even some equipment. And the application period is open until October 24th, 2025. So if you're listening to this and you want to, you're thinking about going organic, you can contact me. I'll have my information in the show notes, as well as if you are interested in just learning more about dry farming and meeting other farmers in the area, you can contact me at the same email.
For farmers to get involved with dry farming techniques and research techniques, even if they're not involved specifically with our organization, it's really fun to be a farmer scientist for your own operation. So it can be useful for farmers to perform things like variety trials across different regional growing conditions, or even with your own microclimates at your individual site. So Organic Seed Alliance has a tool on our website under resources called the Variety Trial Tool. We'll often recommend this for farmers to use to conduct their own variety trial experiments with either crops or varieties specific to a crop. For example, crops that don't normally do well here, like corn or melons, especially on the coastal cooler climate areas, it might be good to test those on a smaller scale before committing to cultivating a large area with a challenging crop or a new variety. Who knows? Maybe you'll even find the next best variety or crop that does well here in Humboldt.
I love that, and I'm going to use that because I've been doing variety trials. I think maybe just based on seeing you guys do it in Shively, and like I know the crew in Shively, we kind of copy what you do a little bit, or did. I don't work there anymore, but I remember a lot of the times out there we would be like, should we grow this way or that way, should we do 1 foot spacing or 18 inch spacing, and sometimes we would just be like, well, let's do them next to each other and see. And it was very informalized, but enough for us to, like, glean some new techniques and results from and get better over time. So I like that you have something that's a bit more formal science that is accessible for farmers or even just backyard gardeners too. And I'll include that as well at the show notes at the end. So if people want to start doing their own rogue plant breeding projects, there's nothing stopping you. The resources are out there.
Yeah, I would just want to end this by really, for any of you that have been listening to us and thinking about growing seed, thinking about developing your own new variety, I would very enthusiastically tell you, give it a try. I think that there are a lot, like I said, Humboldt County is a really great area to grow seeds, and it's also an area where doing your own selecting and improving of varieties can get you a lot of benefits because we are unique. Plant breeding is often done for big commercial regions. Lettuce is bred for, you know, Salinas. Broccoli is bred for Yuma, Arizona. And so you could really get a supercharge your operation by doing trials, like Molly said, to find varieties that happen to work here, or by saving your own seed and selecting and improving varieties to get that those benefits. So if you're thinking about saving seed, I would really take a, you know, if you've never done it before, you can start with an easy crop, crops that pollinate themselves, like most tomatoes or lettuce or peas. And then we've been saying it a few times before, but just to close, take a look. I'll make a final pitch here because I think it's a pretty good set of resources for all of you, which is seedalliance.org is our website. And if you look in our resources page, we have webinars, publications on seed saving and plant breeding and variety trials on dry farming. We have the variety trial tool that Molly recommended. We have just, yeah, whole series is on like selecting tools for your seed saving operation. We have online social forums where you can connect to other seed savers that are working on particular crops. So take a look at seedalliance.org. And I really want to first thank you, Guillem, and also just thank everyone who's listening and encourage you. Consider trying, you know, just one crop. Try saving seed from just one crop this year and see how it goes. I think you're gonna be hooked.